Mapping Elsewhere. Transcript reading of the gallery copy of Mapping Elsewhere. Narrator's note: the text is read according to Mariana's transcript, except where footnotes are separated. The book's bibliography has not been transcribed and is available as a text file. Cover description: the cover features the title Mapping Elsewhere in lowercase, centered above a pencil drawing of a rectangular stone or frame. The frame is decorated with carved leaf and seed motifs in relief, arranged in a looping border around a blank center. Below the image, the author's name, by Mariana Munoz Gomez, is printed in small text. A short introduction: I was born in Pachuca, Hidalgo, Mexico, and my family moved to this place we learned was Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, when I was a young child. I grew up being able to visit my family in Mexico every few years. As an adult, I realized that many immigrants don't have this opportunity of going back home and being with family often. I remember the bicentennial of Mexico's independence becoming a point of questioning for me. I realized that Mexico's Independence Day was a celebration of the country's separation from something, and later came to understand this as a rejection of colonialism. To a certain extent, colonialism, in its legacy and new iterations, continues to function there. Even though I didn't understand it quite so as a teenager, it still caused me to question what Canada was. I thought, Canada hasn't separated from Britain. Canada isn't fighting for its independence from another country. I wondered more about how Canada came to be. In this book, I reflect on some ways I've come to understand my relationship to place, land, home, history, and identity. My parents moved our family here, as most immigrants do, for a better life. I know I would be a different person if we hadn't moved here. I am grateful to be able to come into being here in this place, in so-called Canada. It took until adulthood for me to learn that the story of the making of Canada is involved with genocide, exploitation, dispossession of indigenous peoples from their lands, and occupation of lands. I learned about the idea of terra nullius, a Latin phrase that basically means empty land or nobody's land. This concept was used to justify colonial settler occupation of lands around the world, including here in this land widely known as Canada. This concept aims to erase the long-standing presence of indigenous peoples and their relationships to place, and with the land they live on and travel through. These parts of history aren't presented honestly in the Canadian citizenship test or in Canada's public image to the world. At least, I don't remember learning this in the process of getting Canadian citizenship or in grade school. The fact that I was an adult before I learned these things indicates that colonial narratives attempt to erase truths. I mostly grew up in Winnipeg. Within the last decade, the practice of opening events with a land acknowledgement by the host organization started becoming more popular here, at least to a point where I can remember noticing this becoming a regular thing at a bookstore I worked at. That is to say, where I noticed this becoming a standard practice in the events and places I was involved in. Over these years, the land acknowledgement that has become standard in Winnipeg includes recognizing that the city is located within Treaty 1 territory, and that this is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dehne peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. I have also observed this presented as the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininiwak, Cree, Ahnishininiwak, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. Narrator's comment: Mariana includes footnote next to the Ininiwak, which reads, author, Buck, title, Achakosuk, Ininiwak Stories of the Stars, page 71. The word Ininiwak, also spelled Ininewak and Ininewuk, is an autonym that refers to Cree people. I have learned that similarly, Anishininiwak is an autonym that refers to Oji-Cree people. End footnote. More recently, a land acknowledgement I observed noted that the land that Treaty 1 covers includes unceded territories of Dakota and DEH Nie peoples. Narrator's comment, Mariana includes another footnote here. Lafreniere, land acknowledgement, given during the introduction of the Artworks Renaming Initiative online presentation and panel discussion. End footnote. I have also learned that Winnipeg used to be Red River, a majority Métis city, 3, and that Nestawea is the Cree name originally used for the Forks of the Assiniboine and Red Rivers, and more broadly, Winnipeg. 4. Narrator's comment. Mariana includes two other footnotes here. Red River. Credit to Pharrell Rassette and Matz. Information given during their curatorial tour of Kwatanitawakik. A hard berth at the Winnipeg Art Gallery. Winnipeg. Credit to CBC News. News title. Winnipeg's Nestawea River Trail officially opens with smudge, ribbon cutting. End footnotes. Learning about whose traditional lands these are helps to dispel the narrative of this place as Canadian land. I've ended up doing a lot of my research about Mexico and questioning of place from here in Winnipeg over the internet, which results in some limitations in perspectives. When my family and I visit Mexico, we mostly visit family in the states of Morelos, Puebla, and Mexico City. According to the Atlas de los Pueblos Indígenas de México, translation, Atlas of Indigenous Communities, presented by the Instituto Nacional de los Pueblos Indígenas, translation, National Institute of Indigenous Communities, and El Instituto Nacional de Lenguas Indígenas, translation, National Institute of Indigenous Languages, with data from 2015. There are 35 indigenous communities represented in Morelos's population, Nahua peoples having the highest population. In Puebla, there are 41 indigenous communities, of which Mazateco, Mixteco, Nahua, Popoloca, Tepehua, and Totonaco peoples have the highest population. And in Mexico City, there are 43 indigenous communities, of which Nahua peoples represent the highest population. Native Land Digital is a Canadian organization which incorporates community feedback in their website, nativeland.ca, to map global indigenous territories. Using this website, I see Morelos includes the land of Nahua peoples, including Mexicas, and the Matlatzinco/Tlahuica/Oquiltec. I see Puebla includes the land of Nahua peoples, including Mexicas, the Ngi'iwa, Popoloca, the Ha-Shuta Enima, Mazateco, the Ninu Savi, Mixtecapan, the Chololteca, the Tepehua, the Hnyeju, Otomi, and the Totonaco. And I see that Mexico City includes the lands of the Mexica, the Hnyeju, Otomi, and the Cuicuilco. I share this information because growing up in Winnipeg and visiting Mexico has enabled me to compare my life here and there and try to learn from both experiences. I notice things that have happened differently in each place, which leads me to question what I know about the other. For instance, I haven't experienced being at an event in Mexico that is opened with a land acknowledgement. So here I am sharing what I've learned so far to acknowledge the indigenous lands in all the places I call home. Learning to position myself in the world. Learning about the narratives that inform my reality. Asking questions about who I am learning from. Unfolding my relationship to place and identity will be a lifelong journey. This book is one part of that process, and I welcome corrections from and conversations with anyone who has more information or resources to share. I am grateful for the opportunity to process this learning as an artist. Up to this point, primarily physically here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Narrative. 2,108 words. Narrator's note. The author gives several footnotes throughout the narrative. Footnotes with comments are included following the end of the narrative, but their numbers have been removed from the audio description for flow. Footnotes related only to bibliographic citation have been removed from this description. All drawings are hand-drawn and hand-colored, with each edition slightly different. The following describes the book in the gallery. The narrative begins with an image. End narrator's note. Image description. A small bird perches on a branch, drawn across the center of the page. The branch is rendered in pencil only, while the bird is hand-colored in warm browns with dark speckling along its chest and wings. Warmth. Leaving my oscillating fan to step outside is hardly the fresh relief I thought a cool breeze might bring. I know I've been sitting still for too long, though. A malaise has crept up on me and made time simultaneously linger as it blurs past. So, I welcome the bird songs ringing clearer in my ears and the sun on my neck as my feet lead the way around my neighborhood. I've been going on more walks without purpose lately. No errand, no final destination. Turn the page. Today, I walk past the drugstore instead of turning left. I pass some condos I hadn't noticed before. Suddenly, I am halted by the scent of some leaf, some soil. I realize I just walked past. I don't have a strong sense of smell, so I am surprised that this full aroma has caught my attention so distinctly. I walk back and forth across this patch of sidewalk a few times to try to figure out which plant it could be. A little further, I've started crossing to the shade on the other side of the road and find myself in front of an empty patch of land. A small sign and flimsy chain tell me, "Private property, and do not cross." Only the pillars and iron gates announcing and protecting whatever used to be there remain. Image description. Near the bottom right corner of the page, two irregular smudges of bright, sweet green pigment sit close together. Turn the page. A two-page graphite drawing shows a cracked driveway leading to a gated entrance. Two tall brick columns stand on either side, one on each page, with a chain stretched between them and a small sign hanging at the center. Behind the chain, ornate metal gates recede into a tree-lined courtyard. Sparse fencing and foliage frame the scene on both sides. Turn the page. I guess it's not quite an empty lot. There's soil, grass growing strong, and skinny, tall trees. As I keep walking, just around the bend, another patch of land. Nothing but green, and another small sign. Reading. No trespassing, private property. I hear a crow circling around before I see it choose a tree to land on. I immediately forget what the sign tells me, and I come closer, admiring the sprinkling of light streaming through the trees and onto the grass, buzzing with ants. Turn the page. A two-page pencil drawing fills the spread with dense, repeated marks, suggesting ferns across an open field. Near the bottom, a barbed wire fence stretches across both pages, held up by vertical wooden posts. The posts are hand-colored in brown, each surrounded by tufts of bright green grass. Turn the page. As I keep walking and come back up by the drugstore, I decide I'm not ready to go home. And instead, I walk over the bridge towards the legislative grounds. I head down to the right towards the river, the way I like going on my bicycle to feel the air rush by me. Winnipeg has a lot of Tyndall stone architecture. I see it all around me, in the structures leading down to the river walk, the structures leading up to the legislative building, the platform where a statue of Louis Riel stands. And behind Riel, there is the legislative building itself, on top of which the Golden Boy stands. The Manitoba Legislative Building, completed in 1920, is a significant example of this stone in architecture. Other government buildings throughout Canada, such as Ottawa's Parliament Buildings and the Canadian Museum of Civilization, have used Tyndall stone too, as it is well suited to harsh climates. Image description. A graphite drawing shows a statue of a man standing on a large round pedestal inscribed with the name R-I-E-L. Behind the statue, leafy trees frame the scene, with sections hand-colored in green and the sky lightly shaded in soft blue. In the background, drawn in faint pencil, is a government building with stone columns and a domed roof, left uncolored. Turn the page. Before the official Tyndall Stone began being quarried around Garson, Manitoba, in 1895, a similar limestone had been quarried since 1832 near Lower Fort Garry. In fact, the fort's walls and the governor's residence at this site were built with the Tyndall-esque limestone in 1832. Treaty 1 was signed at Lower Fort Garry 39 years later. Following organized petitions and actions by Anishinaabeg in the late 19th century to prevent further Canadian development in their lands, Canada was forced to meet with them to negotiate a treaty. Representatives of the British Crown and Anishinaabeg negotiators met at Lower Fort Garry in 1871 to discuss the Anishinaabe plan for the region. Treaty 1 was signed by Nehiyawak and Anishinaabeg representatives and those of the British Crown, although the parties involved did not fully understand each other's concepts of land ownership and views of belonging to the land. Anishinaabe Métis legal scholar Aimé Kraft explains, "The Anishinaabe did not surrender their land in the Treaty 1 negotiations. It was not in their power to do so, as they did not own the land. In their eyes, they were in a sacred relationship with the land, endorsed by the Creator. Whereas the Anishinaabeg understood their relationship with land in a way that could be described as fundamentally anti-capitalist, Canadian expansionists built their imagined country on capitalist concepts of land. They understood this land as property to be owned and there for the taking." Turn the page. Image description. Centered on the page is a single hand-drawn slab of stone, lightly shaded in gray tones. Its uneven surface is mottled with soft, swirling marks that suggest embedded textures or fossil traces within the stone. Tyndall stone is fossiliferous. If you live on the prairies in the north, you know it, and you have likely seen it at different scales, from government buildings all around us to the architecture of the Winnipeg Art Gallery, and in smaller features in urban homes. You have found a fossil or two when you've let your eyes wander over it. Turn the page. This limestone has been here for millions of years, absorbing and recording history like a stone I recall at my grandparents' house. Image description. The drawing depicts a bricked arcade curving around a courtyard. Along the ground, ferns and patches of grass grow beside a cluster of rounded stones, some of which are hand-colored in dark gray and bright red. The background arches and columns are outlined in graphite, with textured brickwork detailed in segments. Turn the page. I think of a stone wall at my maternal grandparents' house in Morelos, Mexico. My grandfather was an architect. He built this house my mother and her sisters grew up in. Yet, when I asked him years ago, he couldn't tell me the name of this style of wall. I've seen it in different places in Mexico, so much so that I couldn't tell you specifics. I know I've seen it in Cuernavaca. I'm sure I've seen it in Mexico City. I told my dad about this project I'm working on, and the wall and the stones. He knew the wall I described, but he also couldn't tell me what to call it. He speculated that it might be popular in areas with volcanic rock. Is there a volcano near Cuernavaca? Or was there? I forget that the Popocatépetl is not so far away, although I can always see it in the distance. I pick up my phone and search. I'm reminded that volcanoes live in a different relation to time than we do. El Popo has been busy in its current eruption since 2005. Recently, it has been spewing tall plumes of ash. I Google ejecta, material thrown out, as from a volcano. It has been expelling incandescent ejecta from its depths over the last 6 months or so. Image description. In the lower right corner of the page, a loosely clustered pile of rubble is drawn in graphite. The stone fragments are irregular in shape, with textured shading that suggests rough, broken surfaces. Turn the page. Image description. Three large textured stones are drawn in graphite, spaced slightly apart, and surrounded by a ring of smaller stones arranged in a loose but deliberate perimeter. Most of the stones are uncolored, shaded in gray, with a few along the bottom edge touched with earthy red tones. That stone, I've seen it in the pyramids at Teopanzolco. Esas pirámides del Templo Viejo have been around for hundreds of years, having been built on top of even older structures. As I wonder if it could be volcanic stone after all, from a Morelos long ago, I turn to the internet. After some digging, the World Wide Web confirms that Teopanzolco was built by Tlahuica hands on a foundation of volcanic lava, and that Tezontle, another volcanic rock, was recently found underneath it. I remembered Dash, my grandfather telling me a story of his use of red stone, what I now think may be Tezontle, in the entry of his home. I remember other ruins shown in fragments underneath the Palacio de Cortes, Hernán Cortés Palace. I have walked by so many times to visit the market beside El Palacio, and I have been inside. It is now a museum. But I can't remember what I learned about those ruins. Turn the page. At home on my laptop, I wander through the internet, and I learn that El Palacio was built over a Tlahuica palace. I wonder if any of the darker stone I remember in the facade del Palacio de Cortes is that volcanic stone, same as the one in the walls at my grandparents' house. I recall the cathedral that the Spanish built on top of the Templo Mayor of the Mexica as Tenochtitlan became La Ciudad de Mexico. These stones stay in my mind for a while. Stones that have been used to create homes and claim power over hundreds of years. Recently, I saw a meme from at Queer Sicano Kismi, a.k.a. Ruben Angel. A forlorn yet gently smiling Kermit the Frog is looking at himself in a mirror, reaching out to himself. In the text accompanying the image, Ruben writes about the process of self-identification as a colonized subject of Latin America and how knotted in the unknown it can be. So you reach out to the reflection of a body that you may not know what to call, but is still forever yours. I remember growing up in Winnipeg and seeing commercials on TV for Ancestry.com. I don't think I would find much on there. I didn't have the same words for it, but it's almost like what Ruben was saying. It's what modernity and industrialization and globalization and colonialism and history have done to many of us. Once, before he passed, after I had developed or started developing my thinking on subjectivity, as a person of color in Canada, as an immigrant in Canada, as a Mexican in Canada, as a settler in Canada, as a settler of color in Canada, as a racialized person in Canada, as a child of immigrants, as a child of Mexican immigrants seeking better opportunities for their family, as a child of Mexican immigrants whose trajectory was influenced by capitalism as a subject within settler colonialism within capitalism, as a racialized subject within these systems, as a subject complicit in these systems. Once, before he passed, I asked my maternal grandfather about his roots. Something like, Beto, ¿de dónde eran tus papas? The conversation continued, and I only remember que dijo, Soy Mexicano, muy Mexicano. I didn't get the straightforward answer that I was looking for. I should have just asked, ¿De dónde viene mi piel morena? Is it from my father and my maternal grandfather? Where can I trace their brown skin to? I've only ever known that I am Mexican and that my family has Spanish and German ancestry. When I look at my skin's brownness, I think of my family, and I know that wherever I am, I embody movement and a tangled history. Turn the page. Image description. Near the lower left of a blank white page, a few soft smudges of red pigment appear, uneven in shape and lightly textured. The rest of the page remains unmarked. In the year 2000, my family left Mexico for a second time to settle in Winnipeg. I learn about my place of birth mostly from a distance, mostly on the internet. Turn the page. As for the place I live in, Canada, Manitoba, Winnipeg, I don't recall much from my high school history class, but I know that what I have learned of this place has mostly come from friends, peers, books, memes, and the internet. When we can't rely on schools or the government to teach the full history of this place and what it means today, we have to search for the voices that are teaching. We have to teach ourselves to look for a way to understand what it means to live in this place here. As an adult, I learn that I am not in Canada. I learn that this is not North America. I learn that Winnipeg used to be Red River. This place became a significant site in the history of Canadian expansionism into the Northwest and in the history of Indigenous resistance to dispossession. I learn that Winnipeg is included in the lands encompassed by Treaty 1 and that these are the traditional lands of Anishinaabe, Ininiwak, Anishininiwak, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. Image description. A hand holds up a small rectangular photograph. Inside the photo, a split trunk tree stands in a tidy yard, encircled by a ring of stones. The yard includes a manicured lawn and fencing with bushes and a structure faintly visible in the background. The entire illustration is outlined in graphite, with minimal shading and no color. Turn the page. I learn that people who are indigenous to the area currently known as the state of Morelos may identify with dozens of indigenous communities, including Nahua, Mexica, and Tlahuica communities. I learn that the creation of La Ciudad de México out of Tenochtitlan was one stone in a series of stepping stones that kept Columbus's and Cortez's machines of colonial expansion well-oiled. Image description. Green hills rise along the horizon, their slopes hand-colored in layered color. Below, a loosely sketched town is suggested with minimal pencil marks, hinting at trees and rooftops. In the foreground, a simple fence made from uneven wooden sticks is bound together with strands of wire, leaning slightly with irregular spacing. Turn the page. At some point, I learn that I live on an island. The traditional caretakers of this land, the people who call it their ancestral home, call it Turtle Island in English. Although my consciousness lives on one island, I fly between the nodes of what I've come to know as Canada and Mexico all my life. I do this through memory, language, relationships, photographs, navigating the internet. I do this unexpectedly. When a smell or a taste reminds me of the other, or when I sense something lacking. On Canada Day, when I see maple leaf flags all around me, I think about Mexico's history of some independence from its colonizers 19 and its history of revolution, led in part by Emiliano Zapata. I understand that there is something absent in the celebration of Canada, that its celebratory day is based on taking, not taking back. Turn the page. As I learn about these histories, I form new relationships with each place. I deepen my understanding of the significance of my being within them. I am able to look at this knot more clearly. I realize that untangling it might be an impossible project. Instead, I want to trace the roots that bring me to this cluster. I am present here and now. I mi mente recorre. Image description. A faint sage green smudge marks the lower portion of the page, positioned just beneath the final line of printed text. The smudge is uneven and organic in shape, possibly made by a brush or finger. Turn the page. Image description. A field of rough grass and sparse ferns stretches across the page, drawn with fine pencil lines. Near the top of the image, a wooden post fence with gridded wire marks the background. A soft green patch of foliage is colored in the center and lower area of the composition, standing out against the monochrome field. Acknowledgements. 153 words. Narrator's note. First a paragraph in Spanish, and then English. Doy gracias a mi familia por su apoyo y por ser parte de mi vida. Especialmente a mis abuelos a quienes llegué a conocer, Roberto Gómez Jiménez y Luz María Alarcón Torres, y mis abuelos a quienes no llegué a conocer, Beatriz Marta Rangel Ramos y Felipe Muñoz Luna, a mis papas, Marcela Gómez Alarcón y Manuel Muñoz Rangel, y a mis hermanos, Mauricio y Mónica. Thank you to many friends and peers who have informed this work, shared their research, taken a look, given great tips, or thought past it with me. Abby Auld, Justin Baer, Nor Bangu, Christina Banera, Hannah Ducey, Rachel Thorleifson, John Patterson as Blinkers, Javier Fuentes Martinez, Christina Hajar, Luther Conadu, Chanel Lajoie, Crystal Liu, Zinnia Nakvi, Marie Ann Redhead, Heather Snell. Thank you to Lech Kinlock of Also As Well Too for the Artist Book Mentorship and Creation Program, which spurred this bookmaking, and my mentor, Patrick Cruz. Narrative footnotes on the spelling of Anishinaabe. I have seen this spelled both with one A and two. Thinking back to various conversations and readings, at this time, it is difficult for me to pinpoint a source to cite explaining the difference between these two spellings. I will note that Red Rising Magazine Issue 8, language uses the spelling Anishinaabe throughout. Manitowapau, Aboriginal Writings from the Land of Water, edited by Nieganwewidam James Sinclair and Warren Carew, does as well. Aimé Craft uses the spelling Anishinaabe in Breathing Life into the Stone Fort Treaty. Additionally, Anishinaabeg is a plural form of Anishinaabe, as seen in its use throughout these sources. I welcome corrections and more information from any readers. On the text, Stolen City by Toes, in reference to the signing of Treaty 1, I want to note that Toes is not indigenous. His biography on the QNY Academic Commons website reads, "Born and raised in Winnipeg, he is descended from Russian Mennonites recruited by Canada to occupy southern Manitoba in 1874, I cite Stolen City. Racial Capitalism and the Making of Winnipeg, because reading this book was the first time I came across certain information, and with the specific framing he writes with. For instance, it was the first time I learned that Winnipeg used to be a city named Red River. It was also the first time I read that Canada was forced to meet with Anishinaabeg negotiators for Treaty 1 to discuss their plans for the region. Again, the fact that I learned this about the city I live in as an adult points to how colonial narratives attempt to erase truths and establish one absolute version of history. On stating that the Anishinaabeg relationship with the Lange was fundamentally anti-capitalist, Leanne Betasamosake Simpson describes anti-capitalism as inherent to Anishinaabeg culture in her book As We Have Always Done. She is a member of Alderville First Nation, which describes itself as the home of the Mississauga Anishinaabeg and as part of the Ojibwe Nation on its website. In this way, I understand that the anti-capitalism Simpson describes in Anishinaabeg culture was likely reflected in the culture of the Anishinaabeg Treaty 1 negotiators. Simpson, As We Have Always Done, 76-79. See also History, Alderville First Nation. English translation of Teopanzolco. Teopanzolco is a Nahuatl word meaning the old temple. On using research from Mr. Smith related to Tlahuica, Smith is not indigenous or Mexican. He is an American archaeologist and professor at Arizona State University. His research is the first item on a Google search for Tlahuica. His research dominates the internet in my attempts to learn about pyramids and ancient structures in my family's city. On reflecting on Mexico's history of some independence, consider Mexico's tourism industry and dependency capitalism, for one. I found Angelique Nixon's criticism of how the tourism industry creates conditions of dependency capitalism in the Caribbean a useful point of reflection, integrated with Antonio Benitez Rojo's concept of the repeating island, in connecting the functions of colonialism across disparate places. Citation: Nixon, Resisting Paradise, An Introduction, page 21. End of audio description for gallery.